Matt Wallace, and I'm an alcoholic. I notice he put a watch up here. And when I talk, I sometimes pull a cowl out. But hopefully you won't need that this morning. I won't either. I'm a little bit nervous to begin with, being the first speaker, trying to set the tone for this thing. But I always get nervous when I'm behind the podium. I can't help it. I'm getting old, senile for one thing. And if you see me start wiping up here this morning, it's because I have some store-bought teeth. And I drool a little bit when I get nervous. My wife calls it slobbering. But I just want you to know, if you see me drooling a little bit, that I'm actually not lusting after anyone. Not at my age. I'm just trying to get over the shakes. He pinned this flower on me a little bit ago, and that made me nervous. I feel like I'm a pallbearer. But I don't see any dead folks here this morning. I see some people who are enjoying life. Seem to be that you're serene, you're happy, you're joyous, you're free. And thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because those of us who were caught up in the bondage of alcoholism and the bondage of other facilities, we're free today. And it's because of God's grace and because we found a way of life whereby we don't have to drink and we can live and face life on a daily basis and be happy, joyous, and sane. And I'm grateful for that this morning. I do appreciate the invitation to be here. A little over 2 years ago, we were called and asked to come and share at this place. And it's a privilege for me to be anywhere and to be in an environment like I've been in thus far this weekend. It's absolutely heavenly. Such a beautiful place everywhere we've been up this way. And it's just hard to imagine the difference in the way things look here and the way they look around home. It's just heavenly. I might move up here. My wife might not, but I might. But it is good to be here, and it was a joy coming up this way. Anywhere I go now, I try to enjoy the journey, not just being there. To enjoy the journey. And thank God for the program of AA, because I began this journey of sobriety February 16th, 1964. And it's been a marvelous trip thus far. And I have no intentions of leaving anytime soon. I want to hang around and get more and more of this good sobriety that I'm enjoying today. 46 years is not long. It's not long enough for me. I want much, much more. And I believe that forever how long it is that I can keep on doing it at a day at a time and be sober, as long as I keep on doing the things that I'm doing now and staying with the people that I'm staying now and trusting God and helping others, I believe I can stay on this road till the rest of my days. I have confidence and hope for that. And I was walking earlier out there, and I saw that beautiful wall out there around this graveyard. And it really brought back memories. And years ago, when I was behind the wall, it was very much different. And it was the wall that encircled the North Carolina State Prison, Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm a member in good standing of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina, same group that Tom is in. And I've been a member of that group now for 12 years. Truly grateful for that group. My first home group was the Central Prison AA group in Raleigh, North Carolina, that I went into in June of 63. But I didn't get sober until February of 64. And I went back to that AA group after a suicide attempt. I went back absolutely desperate, looking for a way and means that I could live under those circumstances at that time, a way that I could live a day at a time and have hope and put up with the hell that was going on around me. I wasn't looking for something that I would be able to work in the future. I wanted a way to find a way to live then where I could cope with life on a daily basis. And I thank God for that. I had no idea when I was growing up in Roxburgh, North Carolina, that I would end up in Central Prison. Didn't know that I would become an alcoholic. That wasn't a goal in life. I didn't want to be an alcoholic or a drunk, as a couple of my brothers were called. But I found out when I took my first drink of whiskey, just as Dr. Silkworth talks about in the Big Book, I enjoyed the effects produced by alcohol because I had never felt normal in my life. I had never felt I was as good as other people. I had never been able to socialize and dance and have a good time like other people. And I was just backward and country and uneducated. And all of that changed in November of 1953. At that time, I was stationed at Fort Lee, Virginia. Good place to be in Virginia. I was stationed there, and I went home on a weekend pass. And I went out to a Randy Square dance on Saturday night. And I had been to that dance many times before. And I was doing what I always did when I was out in public with a crowd of people. I was standing back watching you have a good time. Laugh, dance, socialize, just mingle with other people. And feel like you were somebody. And I couldn't do that. I felt so inadequate and inferior. And that particular Saturday night, I vividly remember. I had that Army OD uniform on. I had some little pins on the shoulders to make it look better. I had all the medals on that I'd earned at the PX that afternoon. And I'm standing at a heater just watching people do that thing. The two guys I had come out there with were talking to girls. They had already danced some, and they were having a good time. And I wanted so much to do that, but I couldn't. And I looked at the door and the concession stand over there, and something caught my eye. I never will forget what I saw. I can see it right now. Two humongous protrusions coming that door that night. And they were attached to a beautiful woman. And they came in the door a long time before she did. And she came across that room directly toward that heater, apparently with the intentions of taking me hostage, and she did. When she was talking to me back there at that heater, I was really embarrassed. I was upset. I was restless, ill at ease, and discontent. And she already made me feel even worse because I had been warned about being in the presence of anyone who might be a naughty girl or who drank white whiskey or anything like that. And she was talking to me, and I was looking around, and people were looking at us already and giggling and whispering to each other. I had recognized that woman when she walked across the floor. because of things I'd heard in service stations and pool rooms and garages, and I'd heard some fabulous stories about her. She was talking to me, and I was embarrassed. And I was delighted when she suggested that I escort her out to her car. Apparently, with wolves in the parking lot. And we went out to the car that night and got in an old Chevrolet. And she started that motor up, started the radio up, started the heat up, and had to reach over there under the glove compartment to get to that button up under the passenger's knees. She got that heater going, and she leaned back against me and tried to get me going. And I really became nervous and upset. And we sat in that car for a little bit, and she began to nibble on my ear and say some things I had sort of fantasized about in life, and I really got upset. And eventually, she reached under the seat and got a pint of whiskey, white moonshine whiskey. Got in the glove compartment and two cups and poured out two cups of whiskey. And she was holding that whiskey in front of me. And I thought about what my preacher brother had warned me about. Mom and Dad and that Baptist minister down the hill. And my preacher brother had always given me man-to-man talks, and he told me that if I ever drank white whiskey or run with naughty girls or play with myself, I'd go to hell. I knew when he told me that when I was 14 years old that I'd never had a drink of white whiskey, never had a naughty girl, but I was already in trouble. So I knew I shouldn't get involved with this woman. But when she stuck that whiskey out and I was thinking about the things I'd heard about her, it also made me think about the possibilities of the evening. And it made me think about going to hell too. And I look at her, and look at that whiskey, and I look at them. And then told me to take a drink. And I can tell you that we sat in that car that night in a well-lit parking lot in about 30 minutes' time, drinking two or three more cups of whiskey. An absolute transformation took place in my life that sipping a little beer for the two previous years had not produced. That night when I got in that car, I was 6'2", 140, uneducated, backward, country, fearful of everything, afraid to talk about anything. But that night in that car, slowly, very, very slowly, I evolved to being much bigger. My teeth straightened out, my hair got curly. My muscles began to swell up, all of them. And I knew I was going to be all right. Later on, we went in a dance. And she grabbed me by the hand. We danced. Men were looking at us. They were very envious. We did the bunny hop. And they had to calm me down. I got carried away with that. And I'm not going to tell you everything that happened. But about 2:30 Sunday morning, I lay in bed upstairs. I hadn't vomited on anyone. I hadn't been to jail. I hadn't been on a fight. I had grown up. I had become a man. I had gotten involved in situations I had never been involved in before. I didn't want to go to sleep that night. I just lay there fighting off sleep, reliving each moment. No one beyond a shadow of a doubt, and my preacher brother, Mom and Dad, they had lied to me like dogs, telling me I was going to hell if I drank, and I had been in heaven on Saturday night in that honky-tonk setting, with that beautiful woman and all of the activities that took place afterwards. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that night that they had really lied. Booze was the answer to my problem. It enabled me to act normal, laugh, dance, socialize, and be somebody. I could be like other people. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that Sunday morning that I was committed to buy my first pint of whiskey the next weekend. I did that. And that became a way of life. And very, very shortly, I began to experience blackouts. 6 weeks after that first encounter with that lovely creature, I came to in jail on a Monday morning, laying on the floor in Roxburgh, North Carolina. The last thing I had remembered that Sunday afternoon was drinking vodka with some guys, and it had sneaked up on me. And I blacked out and got caught for drunken driving. And that drunken driving bit lasted off and on for the next 10 years. Many, many, many times arrested for drunken driving. Arrested in Richmond, Virginia. Drunken driving and hit and run. Arrested in Colonial Heights, Virginia. 7 different driving charges. But those are just little minor things that took place in my life as a result of my inability to control my drinking once I started. I'm one of those guys that when I put whiskey into my system, I immediately lost control because of that phenomena of craving that we know about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have turned down many, many drinks because there would only be one drink. Later in my drinking, when I really did get involved in it, I knew that if I took one drink, I would not stop. There would be another and another and another until something would stop me. I was totally unpredictable. I didn't know if I would get fighting liquor, loving liquor, vomiting liquor, crying liquor, sleeping liquor, passing out liquor, driving liquor, stealing liquor. Something was going to happen. Not every time. I had some good times drinking. And some of them I remember. And it's a lot of them I don't. And it's probably a good thing that I don't. But I learned quickly in my drinking that I would come to in the morning wondering where I had been, who I had been with, what I had done, what had happened. I wouldn't know. It would be a blur. And that would be this fear, a haunting fear of what did I get involved in last night. And I never knew. I wouldn't have been surprised if you told me anything that I had done, because some people told me some outrageous things that I had done, and I didn't know a thing about it. But I can tell you this, that alcoholism and the inability to manage my life caused me to walk out on life number one and a little girl, because I couldn't be responsible, I couldn't be decent, couldn't pay phone bills, light bills, water bills. I was living to drink and drinking to live. And when I walked out of the apartment one night heading back to Fort Lee, Virginia in January of 1959, I knew I would never enter that apartment again. And when I threw my thumb up down on Highway 49, heading over to 58 to come into South Hill, Virginia, and then up number one to Petersburg and Fort Lee, when that truck stopped to pick me up, and I crawled up in the cab of that Mack truck, he said, "Soldier, why are you crying?" Couldn't tell him I was walking out on a wife I didn't love, a little girl that I did love, but I couldn't be a father, couldn't be a husband, I couldn't be responsible. because I was obsessed with drinking, drinking, drinking. And I didn't want to be that way. At Fort Lee, Virginia, late on after returning from Korea, I had sworn off in Korea for 5.5 months. I knew over there that when I was en route to Korea that I had to do something differently if I wanted to stay in the Army. I had gone back in through the National Guard, had re-upped, went regular Army, and in 5.5 months in Korea, with no drinking, with going to school at night, with really soldiering, I was promoted to sergeant. I had been company soldier of the month 5 times, battalion soldier of the month 3. Same day those sergeant stripes were sewed on, I went to the NCO club to buy my friends some drink. That was customary in service. And I sat in that club, and the alcoholism that I have, which I did not know I had, I just thought I had a bad drinking habit, began to talk to me and tell me I had done real well. I had influenced people. I had gotten along with the Koreans, the GIs, and I had impressed people. And that's why I had been promoted. And that I owed it to myself to celebrate and socialize a little bit with these guys I worked with. I made the mistake of drinking a beer with them. And since nothing happened, I drank another beer. And then since the beer was not affecting me any whatsoever, I decided to get a few shots of old granddad and Coke. And you know the story. Within 2.5 hours, I was thrown out of that club because I had become a nuisance. I made a fool of myself. Don't know what I did, but I made a fool of myself, and that threw me out. And I had begun drinking on duty over there. And it wasn't long before I was court-martialed. It wasn't long before I was a corporal again. And back in Fort Lee is when I went home and furnished an apartment and moved that wife and baby in. And then I walked out of that apartment on a Sunday night, knowing I could not be a husband or a father. And the story continued at Fort Lee, Virginia. The charges in Richmond, the charges in Colonial Heights. My inability to walk through the day room and hold my head up with dignity and respect because I had none. Because I had been accused and reprimanded by the company commanders so many times for coming in, being a nuisance, falling over footlockers, slamming wall locker doors, vomiting in the mess hall. I didn't want those things to be going on in my life. And I couldn't stop it because I couldn't stop drinking. And when I drank, I was totally unpredictable, as I've said before. And it wasn't long before the company commander sent me to a chaplain for counseling. And that didn't work. He sent me to a psychiatrist for counseling. That didn't work. And then when the prosecuting attorney in Richmond brought up all those charges, I had appealed from low court into high court. He called it come to commander and said, when this guy, Corporal Bryant, I was at the time, when he's tried, if he's found guilty, he'll pull a pine. Well, the company commander took action and put my record before a board of 12 officers who every one of them unanimously agreed that I had become alcoholically unfit for military service, and they booted me out. And they were right. When I went to court the next day, I was given a 90-day jail sentence. And some 57 days later, I got out because I had been a trustee in jail. Good job. If you're in jail, be a trustee. A cleaning courthouse, frying salt herrings for breakfast, cleaning up a drunk tank, shoveling snow. I did anything to get my time cut. Some 57 days later, I got out of jail because my lovely girlfriend was up there to get me out. She was only 19 or 20 years older than I. And she was out in the parking lot in an old dilapidated automobile to get me out. And she had all of her grandchildren with her. And that morning when I walked out to the car, Ruth apparently was looking in the mirror and saw me coming out of the jail, and she met me at the trunk. And when I got to the car, I told her, I said, Ruth, I'll never go to jail again. Not as long as I live. She said, let's drink to it. And she pulled out a pint. I reached over and got that pint. I hadn't seen one in 57 days. And I toasted that jail, took a couple of slugs on it. And I didn't take enough, so I took a couple more. And I handed it to her, and I remember she spit her snuff out, and she took one. And the next morning, Ruth was up there again to get me out because her brother-in-law and sister from Washington, D.C. had come down to help Ruth and her lover celebrate his getting out of jail. And Mac got caught for drunken driving that night, and I was in the back seat, passed out. And when they locked him up, they locked me up. I couldn't even pass out without getting in trouble. And that continued, that lifestyle continued for the next year in Colonial Heights, Virginia, living in that old dilapidated shack that she lived in, getting jobs, losing the job a week or 2 weeks later, over and over. And finally, Mom and Dad wanted me to come home, and I waited one day until Ruth went to work. And I hitchhiked back to Roxburgh, moved in with Mom and Dad to help them out in their old age. I moved in with all my worldly possessions, what I had on my back. And they said, no drinking. And I knew they meant it. And for the next 5.5 months, it's by coincidence, I'm sure, there was no drinking. I worked in the mill at night, stayed with them, stayed at my father's store. Went with them to church. They introduced me to a lady that was 8 years older than I, and she was going to be my salvation. And 5.5 months after I moved back in with Mom and Dad, that lady asked me to marry her. She had a house and 13 acres of land, and an automobile, good job. And I had 2 pants and 2 shirts. And that wasn't a bad deal. We got married. 3 weeks later, we went to a dance. I know Baptists around here probably don't dance. They don't at home. They won't even have sex standing up. They're afraid somebody think they're dancing. But Sue was different. Sue was different. She loved to dance. And I got up that night and tried to dance with her. And I had 9 left feet. When she wanted a dozy, I wanted a duck. And I couldn't do it. She went to the powder room with a friend's wife. And while she was gone, he handed me a glass of old granddad. And I drank that old granddad. And as she got back, I was ready to dance. When the dance was over that night, they had to wake me up. I was passed out at a table at the back of the room. My wife went out the door crying, and I went out the door behind her vomiting and cursing. And I put that woman through a lot of hell for the next year. Many, many times I tried to quit drinking during the summer of 62. I couldn't do it for more than a day or two or three at a time. And I feel like I was going to fly to pieces. I was doing carpenter work. And I just couldn't stop drinking. And I knew I was a hopeless case. This was all I'd ever be. My wife was constantly reminding me I'd always be a hopeless drunk. And this went on through the summer of 62. before Christmas of 62, I bought my Christmas liquor 2 or 3 times. And I didn't have any at Christmas. I'd steal money from my wife's pocketbook. Well, I wouldn't steal it. I'd leave a note saying, the bandit has struck again, I'll pay you back payday. So she'd know where it went. I did this many, many times. And she was really getting disgusted. The third week in January of 63, I had been drinking for the most part since before Christmas. I hadn't worked very much. I had to work some in order to get liquor money. I had missed a lot of child support payments for the past several months. But I was getting enough work and money to do some drinking with. And the third weekend, we quit work on a Friday because it was raining. In January of 63. And I don't recall going home that Friday night, or Saturday night, or Sunday night. I remember my wife, number two, was shaking me very hard Monday morning, asking me, was I going to work? And I said, yes. And when I turned to get off the bed that morning, I remember that my elbow hit something on the pillow. It was hard. It made a clanging noise. And I raised up the pillow. It was 2 pints of white moonshine whiskey on that pillow. I sat there that morning and began drinking that white whiskey. And what I'm telling you now is what I had to learn from other people, from what I read in the paper, in jail later, or what family members told me. But apparently late that morning, after my wife had gone to work, that I went to the bootleg beer joint nearby, called a taxi, went to town. I heard people testify who were running the joints of town that they would not serve me that Monday afternoon because I was drunk. I heard a sheriff testify that he had looked out the window that afternoon at 4 o'clock. And he saw me on the street drunk. He was going to come out and arrest me. His secretary was not in the office that day. The phone rang on the other side of the room, and he went over to answer it. And he said he didn't talk on the phone for more than a minute, but when he came back to the door, I was gone. And he figured the police had me or would have me in a few minutes. And it was an extremely cold Monday, and he forgot about it. And I wished an awful lot of times that he had arrested me. I was arrested the next morning, 21st, for offenses that had been committed that Monday afternoon after the sheriff had saw me on the street drunk. And I'm not going to share everything with you because it's, I hear people share things behind the podium that should not be shared from behind the podium. And it would not help you to get sober. It would not make you drunk. But it's very, very painful to talk about. But I was arrested next morning on January 21st. And on February the 11th, I stood in Superior Court, unable to defend myself because of having been on a blackout. The lawyer said we stand mute at first. And then later on, the judge asked me to stand. He had listened to the evidence presented by the sheriff. And then he stated, young man, for the offenses committed, I hereby sentence you to the North Carolina Department of Correction for a period of 40 years and then natural life at the expiration. And it was 2 days later, handcuffed and shackled between 2 other people, I was taken into the walls of Central Prison, and I had never been in prison before. But when that door on my right-hand side was slammed shut that Wednesday afternoon at 3:20, a feeling of relief come over me. I knew I was exactly where I belonged. I had lost my right to be in a free society with you people. I did not belong right here. I knew I would not have to bring any more heartbreak or shame or degradation on the name of my good family. I knew I would not have to hurt anyone else again. And I knew that I would not have to drink anymore. And that was the biggest relief of all. I knew there was not supposed to be anything in the walls of Central Prison. And I went in and stood before the committee about a week later. And the associate warden looked at those commitment papers. 40 years plus natural life. And reminded me that if I had any intentions of ever walking outside in a free community again, I had to be a good boy. And I knew I was going to be a good boy because I didn't like that place. I had learned enough in 7 days or 8 days that I didn't like that place. And I had good intentions. But 3 weeks later, as a result of an inability to sleep, to put up with the food, the clothing, the harassment, the hell that goes on in a prison environment, I fell by the wayside because the guys took me into their confidence and told me that how things were being smuggled in by free people who wanted to make additional money, told me about the little bottles of alcohol being smuggled in out of the Central Prison Hospital, and I began to use those things. That was within 3 weeks after I went into the prison. And then in June of 63, as a result of having been locked up, as a result of my attitude, I got fired. I got fired from my job in the classification section as a clerk. Was sent to work with Prince Jacques. Also, a couple of other things happened in June. I went to a crazy meeting they had, and for some reason it was called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why I went to that meeting, whether it was to get out of the cell block, whether it was by invitation of some other guys or what, but I went. And also, one other thing that happened is that my wife back home had a surprise when she got home from work off third shift one morning. When she went into the house at 7 o'clock, a man was waiting in the bedroom. She was assaulted, she robbed, and kidnapped. And when I found out about that at Central Prison about a week later, I went to the doctor to get something to settle my nerves. And I used that little slip of paper that enabled me to be legally under the influence of something out on the yard that could lock me up. I used that for as long as I could. But I still attended AA, sat in the back of the room, had my name on the prison group roster, but I was certainly not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do anything. And that went on for 8 months. And during that 8 months, I would have these week or 10 days. I tried to get off of this mess, and I couldn't. I had good intentions, but I couldn't follow through on them. And I just continued that way, unable to cope, use and not use, and drink and not drink, on and on. February 16, 1964. I hope and pray to a loving God. I never forget the bottom I hit that night. I came to in my cell block, way up on the fourth floor, 40 feet below to the concrete. I came to on that bunk that night. And I took a look at where I was in life. I was a hopeless, helpless drunk. unable to get drunk and stay drunk for as long as I wanted to stay drunk. Unable to get sober because having my name on the prison group roster does not provide sobriety. Couldn't get drunk and stay drunk as I wanted to, and couldn't get sober. No program of recovery. Had no future. Nothing absolutely pleasant to look forward to. Not with a sentence like I had. It was a hopeless situation. Couldn't think about the past. It was too painful thinking about the things that had happened in my life. The hell that I'd put my family through. The broken promises, the wasted money, the tears, the prayers that went up in vain. Couldn't think about the past. Couldn't tolerate the present, the walls, the food, the harassment, the hatred, the bitterness, all of that. I had nothing to live for. And I had entertained the idea many times of suicide. And I made up my mind that night. This would be an ideal time to get this misery, this torment over with. I'm going over that railing tonight when that door opens at 9 o'clock. And it opens every night at 9 o'clock when guys on the bottom floor were watching television. They could go into the cell block at 9. If not then, they would have to stay downstairs until 11. And I knew that door would automatically open when that sergeant pulled that lever that night at 9 o'clock. And I committed myself to going over. I reached on the pillow and took everything I had under there that was illegal to take. I drank that last bottle of alcohol. And I stood at that door, ready to plunge. You know, Bill Wilson talks about we stood at the jumping off place. And that's where I was, fully committed, ready, anxious to go. You can call it sickness, blackout, passing out, whatever you choose. I choose to believe that a loving God gave me one more shot at life. I came to that night, sometime later on, in front of the commode. A roll of vomit was from the door to the commode. And I was on my knees on that concrete floor with my head in that commode, crying and gasping and praying. And I passed out. Sometime later, came to and crawled in my bed. The next morning, I had been in that two-man cell alone that night because my cellmate was in the hospital with the virus. The next morning, when the guards opened the door and we had to go out for breakfast, go to our respective jobs. The guys in the cell block on the right and on the left said, "What was going on in there last night?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "Last night you cried out loud enough for us to hear you. God, if you help me get back to AA, I'll try." I don't remember saying that. I'll pray it. But those guys certainly had no reason to make up such a story as that. And I can tell you this, at the following Thursday night when the AA meeting met, I went into that AA group absolutely desperate, determined some way, somehow, to find out what you people had, that maybe it would work for me on the inside a day at a time. And I didn't sit down at the back of the room. I went up to the front of the room, sat down on the left side, and that became my seat. I continued to do that. And about 2 weeks later, the old man sitting here on the front row, Tom, I had a little talk with him after the meeting one night. And he gave me a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't buy it. It belonged to Central Prison. But he gave it to me and told me what I needed to do with it. And I took that book back to my cell block. And I began to get into it. And I'd read in it every night. And it was only one AA meeting a week at Central Prison at that time. He had 7 years of sobriety at the time. And he was working as an alcoholic rehabilitation officer. I'd get into that book and I'd read it. And I got active in that group. And I don't know of any inmate that's ever been any more active in Alcoholics Anonymous than I was during the entire next 17 years. Because I certainly found out after a very short excursion into that big book that I had been an alcoholic since I was 20 years old. And it was an absolute relief for me. Some people could be ashamed to be called an alcoholic. That was the best promotion I'd had. And I found out I was an alcoholic. And I got active in that group, and for the next 2 years, I was active in that group. But periodically, I have this obsession. And I have this fear. I have an obsession to use something or drink something. I had this fear that due to my hectic past, there's no way that Alcoholics Anonymous will ever work for me on a long-time basis. There's no way. I'm too different. I had that fear for the next 2 years, and then I went to Tom again and talked to him. And he wanted to know what step I was on. I said, I've worked 1, 2, and 3. And that's all we had heard about because we didn't have any discussions about the steps. Now and then I'd hear a free person talk about the steps. And it was 1, 2, and 3. I didn't hear anything about him. They might have said it, but I didn't hear it. But anyway, he asked me what step was I on. And I told him I'd work 1, 2, and 3, and I've been waiting for God to zap me whereby I could tiptoe through the tulips. But it had not happened. And he said, it probably won't. And he told me what to do, go back to step 1 and start over. And then when you get to that 4th step, making that searching and fearless moral inventory, find out what the exact nature of your wrongs are. And then you go into step 5. And sit down and admit to God, to yourself, and to another human being about the exact nature of your wrongs. And then get into 6 and 7 and pray about those character defects and shortcomings. And then in 8 and 9, listen to those people you wrong and make amends. And I thought to myself, how can I make amends? As much money as I owe, and I'm broke as a convict. But I found out that I could write some letters, and I sure was glad that I wrote those letters. Because some years later, when I was given a temporary parole to go home to my daddy's funeral, and 56 days later, go home to my mother's funeral, I saw people that I had written those letters to. And it really helped me to approach them and talk about their wrongs and ask for forgiveness of the things that I had done. Those letters really helped. I got active in that group and tried to my best to live by the principles of AA and carry the message to other inmates. And sometime after that, Tom became dissatisfied with the AA group itself. Because they were so far removed from actually being what an AA group ought to be. He shut it down, stopped AA in Central Prison, and met with 4 or 5 of us who were trying to live the program. And then started AA back. And grew from one meeting to two a week. Grew from two a week to three a week. Whereby inmates were carrying a message to each other. We had a beginner's meeting. And just grew in the AA way of life. And an awful lot of good things happened to many of us who were in that triangle AA group. In fact, we had changed the name of it from the Central Prison AA group to the Triangle AA group because of Unity Recovery Service. That's why we named it the Triangle AA group. And many of us found a way of life. To make a long story short, I stayed in a total of 18 years, 1 month, 26 days, and 2 hours. And during those last years, I was not in Central Prison. In 68, and I don't think I've ever told this any time before. In 68, after the riot at Central Prison that had happened, on April 16th and 17th of 1968, we had the best AA group you could possibly imagine. The best I've ever seen or ever heard of in a prison facility, whereby people were living the program behind the walls of Central Prison, where some of us had completely found freedom. Freedom from the bondage of self, but not freedom from the bondage of an institution. And that riot came up in 1968. And 7 people were killed. Over 100 of us, and many of us who were not involved in it, were severely beaten and injured and ended up in the hospital for weeks. And I was one of those that was caught up in that. And I know that through God's grace and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that for some reason, I was allowed to survive. I know that when Tom and the inside sponsor of the group was looking for me that night, they found me laying in the corner hallway of the prison hospital. And they moved me and bodily carried me over their shoulders to the operating room. They didn't operate on me because they couldn't operate on my face where the bones were broken. 3 places are in here. A concussion on my arm, the back of my head, a hip injury whereby I limped for more than a year after getting out of the hospital. For some reason, I was spared. And I know that I had that serenity prayer on the ledge of the windowsill, and that thousands of times I prayed that prayer in that hospital room before I was allowed to go back to work. Not only was I hurt physically, I was hurt mentally because I knew that that triangle AA group as such would never, ever, ever, ever have the opportunity to meet together again, and it never did. Some 3 or 4 months later, several of us who had been members of that group were allowed to meet in a dormitory in a little cubbyhole-like area and start AA up again with Tom. And then out at the on a grade unit, when I was transferred out there, I worked in the program to help 30-day to 6-month public drunkenness offenders for 2 years. Tom was transferred, got a promotion as superintendent. of the Sanford of Asperson. 3 weeks later, he transferred me up there. And I remember the day that he carried me into the Sanford Correctional, or Sanford of Asperson, as it was called at the time. I had on honor gray green clothing, brogan shoes. I had a cigar box. And in that cigar box was a comb, a safety razor, a toothbrush, some toothpaste, and that was my worldly possessions. He had a check for $27 that was to be placed in my trust fund. That was my worldly possessions. And never did I dream at that time that someday Sanford would be my home. I was still living the program. And shortly after I arrived at Central Prison, we started an AA group there in March of 71. That group is still going today. Tom was transferred eventually again to another unit where he was in charge of 3 prisons. And I had to stay there because I wasn't running nothing but the clothes house, the lawnmower, the buffer, such things as this. But eventually I was approved to go on work release. And I went on work release, and my wife, number 2, came up to see me. She had been standing by me for years while I was in Central Prison. She had heard me speak in an AA meeting outside. She had heard some other people speak about AA. And she came to the advancement center, and she says, "Wallace, it looks like you're going to be getting out maybe in a few years." And says, "When you get home, you're going to have to give up on this AA thing. It's of the devil. It's a cult." And I listened to her, and I thought for about probably 30 seconds. And I says, "If you think AA is of the devil, it's a cult, if you think I'm going to give up on it, you can go to the devil." And I said, "Don't come back to see me. If you don't divorce me, I'll divorce you." 2 years later, the man that's in our AA group now had become superintendent since Tom was shipped off to be director of another institution. He carried me to a lawyer's office about getting a divorce. And when I came out of that lawyer's office that day, the president of the phone company was in the lobby of that office. And he says, "Wallace, if you ever approve for work release, you have a job with the telephone company." About 6 or 8 months later, I went to work with the telephone company. And I retired from that telephone company in 93 after 20 years of excellent service to that company. And never once did I get arrested for drunken driving, assaulting anyone, stealing anything, fighting with anybody. Never no arrest. I had a driver's license all that time. Still got one. 3 years before I got out, I went with my church. I had bought land. I went to a church with my sister. She had a mobile home on the land they had given me permission to buy. And I went to church with her because when you're on home leave, you have to go with your sister, whoever who it is, to sign you out. It's just like having a chain gang guard with you. I went with her to church, and I'm outside on the curb smoking one Sunday morning. And this little lady walked down the street, and she went up the steps in the church. And I hadn't even seen a face, and I liked the looks. And 3 weeks later, she stuck that little hand out to me on that walkway one Sunday morning. She says, "Wallace, you're Marlene's brother, aren't you?" Says, "I'm Bobby Jean." She said, "We're mighty glad to have you at church. I said, I'm mighty glad to be here, ma'am. 3 years later, she had enough confidence in me and my program of recovery that she accepted my proposal for marriage while I was incarcerated. We'll have 32 years, May 26. I talked with her a little while ago from out here. She's fine. She's at home. My dog was okay, too. I got out in 81 on parole. I got out, stayed on parole 5 years. And one day when I got off work with the phone company, I walked right down to the mailbox to get my papers, my mail. And I opened a letter from the North Carolina parole system as I was walking up the driveway. And that letter says, "Congratulations, Mr. Brown. You have completed your obligation to the state of North Carolina. You've done it with dignity and respect. You are a citizen again. You are a free man." And Bobby Jean had come from work at J.C. Penney Company where she worked in the office. And she saw me crying as I came up the driveway. And she took the letter and she began to read it. She says, "What's wrong with this letter? It says you're a free man." I said, "There's one thing wrong about that letter. That letter says that the North Carolina Department of Correction says that I'm a free man. What it's actually saying is that they are turning me loose from supervision." I said, "I became a free man in 1966. When I sat down, took my first step, and a few months later, when I sat on the prison curb and realized that God in His infinite mercy through this program of recovery had relieved me of the bondage and obsession of alcoholism, that I had no longer craved a drink since then, and that even back then in Central Prison, I had had wall-to-wall sobriety. I had earned the dignity and respect that I had never had with anyone before. And I had become absolutely free behind the walls of Central Prison. And when I saw these walls down here this morning around that graveyard, it helped me to realize that I'm not in a program whereby people are dead. I'm in a program where people are enjoying life. And that through His grace and by working this process of recovery as outlined in the Bible, by keeping a sponsor, by sponsoring other people, by carrying that message into institutions on a weekly basis, I'm going to say so. I believe that with all my heart. That home that I built, always given permission to have built, during the last year of my incarceration, that home was paid for within 12 years because I knew where my money was being spent. I knew that it was not being wasted in the company of people that I should not be with. I was staying in the presence of members of Alcoholics Anonymous and enjoying life. And today I'm still happy, joyous and free. I enjoy many things in life. Golf, racing, basketball. I don't appreciate the way that Virginia Tech beat up on Carolina. But I have to accept the things that I cannot change. There's a lot going on in my life. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I remember those commitment papers. in 1963. And for those of you who don't know what commitment papers are, commitment papers are those papers signed by a Superior Court judge, legal documents that enable the Department of Correction to lock up one forever how long it states on that commitment paper. That's what commitment meant to me for quite a while in Central Prison. Commitment today, to me and for many, many years, has meant something quite different. Commitment today means that I am responsible to carry this message of recovery. I am responsible to reach out to the sick, suffering alcoholic. I'm responsible for going into those institutions and sharing the freedom, the hope, the love, the way of life that you people brought into me behind the walls of Central Prison. That's what commitment means to me today. And I'm grateful for that commitment, and I intend to keep it for soever, as long as God will let me. And I believe that as a result of trying to be in His will on a daily basis, I can keep that commitment on and on and on. I love you.